A podcast of the cinema.
I'm Alonzo Duralde.
You are not.
I just called me by your name.
Oh, I see what you did there.
So, keep going.
So
who are you?
I'm Dave White.
That's right. That's right. We just called each other by our names.
Go. Don't ever do that again.
Because it's gay.
Because of movie.
How'd you like that? Turkey tetrazzini.
That was real nice.
Late lunch, early dinner.
Yes.
That's that kind of after church situation.
It is a nap-inducive kind of meal.
Like when you, go on Sunday, you get up, go to church, and you come back, and you get back by 12:30-ish or so, and then Sunday dinner is 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right.
And then the rest of the day, you ain't doing nothing. That was some Sunday dinner.
12:30? Was there fellowship afterwards? Is that the deal?
Oh, God. You don't know nothing about... you Catholics and your on-time short situations. Preacher gets going. You could sit there for a while.
Oh, okay.
Gotcha. There's no telling when you're going to be done.
Look, I've sat through my share of some snoozy homilies, but I'm sure they were not nearly as lengthy as...
No. We never called them homilies.
Well, sermons, I know.
Let me tell you, a homily is about 15, 20 minutes.
Not in the hands of some priests, trust me.
Well, run of the mill. Let's even say 30 minutes, right?
Sure.
Okay. Southern Baptist preacher gets going. You can be in there for a couple hours.
There might be some tongues.
It is. It gets, yeah. You better not have anyone waiting for you. It might start at 11, and you might be done at 12:30.
Gotcha.
If you're lucky, and he's not feeling up to the task,
12:30 is a breeze.
You'll be out that. You'll be out by noon.
Gotcha.
Maybe.
Gotcha.
But no, because you got to sing.
Of course.
You got to have the sermon. You got to have the altar call. You got to have people that just got saved. You got to have. You got to have the after. Thing where right. Everyone stands around and talks for 100 years
and has coffee or punch
then,
or whatever.
Yeah, and then maybe you get to go home for Sunday dinner.
Gotcha.
But that's I just did that for you.
Yeah.
I just made sure that turkey got used up, and even though that was not Thanksgiving turkey, I mean it was turkey that I made,
right?
But it was made well before Thanksgiving and just saved.
Yes. We unplugged for a couple days for Thanksgiving, which was nice. And if this is your first time listening to the show, we will get to the movies.
Maybe.
At some point.
In a minute.
I was on 2020 this week, so who knows who we've found in the podcast universe listen to this show.
I forgot about that. It's only been 4 days. Mm. I forgot that you were on that 2020 special.
I was.
I know that your Amazon ranking for your book just shot up.
Yes.
Because of being on 2020.
I am now one of the top 50,000 books
right.
on Amazon, and that's a good thing.
That's a majorly good thing. That means you sold a dozen or two dozen copies.
Yeah, because usually, I try to explain to people, usually right. my book ranking on Amazon is in the seven digits. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. In the middle of July, my Christmas book is at about 2 million something on the rankings.
The name of the book is Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas.
It certainly is.
If you've been listening to this podcast for 7 years... You know that by heart.
You've heard a thing or two about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, going on TV got me up to the 49,000. It's very exciting.
People sat through that whole boring special, and then there was you.
I hope they sat through it.
And then it was great. Well, obviously they did because...
I mean, our friends who watched it and said they watched it, yeah, they... But I don't... I mean... America. I don't right. know if they endured the whole thing or
well,
not.
A lot of people did because they got to you and they bought your book.
I guess so.
No. It wasn't, there's no other explanation.
Indeed.
it's been out for so long. It's not like it's flying off a shelf anywhere.
No. But, you know, look, I've been out there hoofing it. We were just on Madeline Brand talking about it on KCRW. Right. And I will be in the weeks to come. You can hear me talking about that dang book on Fat Guys of the Movies. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be on a show called Battleship Pretension.
It's going to be so exciting.
Doing a thing in Los Angeles. If you've never been to a Voyager Institute screening that Brett Berg puts together on December 3rd, he's going to be showing a mercifully truncated version of Jack Frost with Michael Keaton, not like, the other Jack Frost.
Is it like a 7-minute supercut?
It's like a 45-minute supercut. It's still a good half of the movie gone. So, okay, you know. Well, and then he and I are going to have a nice onstage chat
Still 45 minutes of...
It is still 45 minutes of your life, yes. And then we'll be talking about Christmas movies. So, yeah, I'm working it.
Indeed, you are. Why don't we begin with Darkest Hour?
Oh, sure.
It is from Joe Wright.
Yes.
And he made the good Pride and Prejudice movie that I
like. It's fine.
Oh, I really like it.
It's not my favorite Austin movie.
Keira Knightley and...
It's not even my favorite Pride and Prejudice. I think it's not as good as the miniseries.
Well, fine. Say what you like. Here's
the
thing.
I don't like the other Joe Wright movies at all. Like, at least, I mean, what have I didn't like Atonement.
I liked Atonement.
I didn't see Anna Karenina. You hated that one, and you kept me from having to go.
I did not enjoy Anna Karenina, no.
What else did Joe Wright do?
Hannah
was okay. I didn't like that as much as most people did.
I was into Hannah. That's, you know, those are the big...
So, yeah, a Joe Wright film is not a selling point for me. Right. Much like a Ben Wheatley film is not a selling point for me. So, this is a Joe Wright joint, and it is the you know, as I joked when we were on KCRW, the movie should just be called Gary Oldman Would Please Like an Oscar, Thank You.
Now that I've seen it, I agree with you.
Yeah.
But I don't think... that Gary Oldman went into this film thinking, ah, my Academy Award, finally.
He may or may not have. I don't know.
I mean, I'm not...
I have not looked inside his soul.
I don't assume that every actor is the, you know, when is it Winslet's turn? You know? I
You'd be surprised.
No, I'm sure that some of them are thinking like, this might do me right.
Yeah.
Like this movie. But he plays Winston Churchill at the beginning of World War II.
Yes.
And he plays Winston Churchill, and Joe Wright directs him toward a Winston Churchill that is... like Commander McBragg.
Yes. A cartoon that nobody but us remembers. It was part of what, Tennessee Tuxedo?
Maybe.
It was like a side dish.
We're 100 years old.
Yeah. And look on YouTube.
So, he's very much a, you know, bacon and I...
My jowls!
Yeah, the scotch for breakfast. And
he's wearing a lot of very effective makeup. I mean, you can barely tell that it's Gary Oldman in there.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's that thing of, the thing I always like to say... Where I always say that, you know, the Academy, especially at this time of year, likes acting they can quantify.
Right.
They can hold in their hands and weigh it. It's so heavy. All that makeup and the voice. And,
right.
And fat and, you know, whatever it is. They can go, that's acting.
I mean, it's, if you know anything about World War II, you know that he led England... in a vigorous way.
Yes.
Through the war. And is, I guess, considered by, you know, the people to have been a highly effective and rousing leader.
Certainly.
I don't know if he yelled quite as much as Gary Oldman does in this film. But if he did, he had a reason to. And, well, why don't you say what you think of this film?
Yeah, it's... Bob Strauss, did you read Bob Strauss's piece in the LA Daily News?
I did.
About the bad British invasion?
Yes.
You know, like all these Victoria and Abdul movies that are just such sort of desiccated historical pieces.
Yes.
You know, I when I was watching this movie, all I could think of was like, if Hitler didn't exist, we would have had to make him up as a movie thing, just because there's so many movies where we're patting ourselves on the back for having been right about Hitler, you know, and this whole movie is about how, like, you know, Chamberlain and Lord Halifax or whoever are all about, no, appeasement and peace. Right. And Churchill's like, no, we must destroy Hitler because I'm Churchill.
Yeah.
You know, and you can certainly make a movie about these kinds of events, and I mean, this year we've had several interesting, you know, a lot of Dunkirk is happening during this movie, and we had Dunkirk this year, we had Their Finest this year, both of which take place around the same time.
Yes.
But there's none of that. You have to figure out a way to make a foregone conclusion suspenseful, which this movie doesn't do.
Okay.
You have to drive home the idea that a thing that we now know in retrospect was totally the right move seemed a controversial choice at the time.
Yes.
I don't think the movie does that all that well. There is this super hokey sequence that I'm sure never, ever happened.
No, of course not.
Where Churchill takes the tube so he can ask everyday Londoners what they think about Hitler and should they go to war. And it just all smacks of super phoniosity, this movie. You know, I like the scenes with his wife, because his wife is played by Kristen Scott Thomas and she's always great. But yeah, this movie felt so self-congratulatory, and not that the Churchill didn't do great things, but they don't give you enough context to make you understand why what he did was a risk, you know, or daring or whatever. And I get that right now we're at a point in history where we want to see a movie where a political leader behaves like an adult and makes rational choices.
Yes.
So I understand the escapist appeal of that.
Yes.
But I don't think this is a very good movie.
I'm going to disagree with you. I think that Joe Wright is the kind of meat and potatoes sort of guy.
Tea and crumpets.
Yeah. Where everything here is so obvious and on the nose. Every move the camera makes, every line of dialogue, every plot beat is designed to push you a little more and rouse you a little more and to get you hyped up for fighting Nazis. The fact that young people will probably not go see this movie also, I think, might go a little bit toward explaining the way that lack of explanation is, you know, happens the way you said it, because we know we're middle-aged people. We know about this stuff. We know what went down. And so
they're literally just preaching to the choir.
Because there's no one but Academy Award enthusiasts and the people who go see movies like this, grown-ups,
yes,
are going to see this movie. And they're going to admire Gary Oldman. They're going to feel good about, you know, the Allies in World War II. They're going because they love vintage tweed. They're going because...
typewriters.
They're going because all those reasons.
Well, I'll tell you. I know that I've been hammering home on this movie all year, and people are sick of me talking about it.
Their Finest. It's such a great film.
Is. Yeah. And it does all those things in terms of it gets you riled up and spirited and makes you understand why the war effort was important and all the things that Britain had to do at that time.
And it's legitimately heartbreaking.
Yes. And the horror of the Blitz.
Yeah.
You know, all that stuff. So first person and so direct and wrapped up in a package that is as rousing and emotional as the kind of propaganda movies that it's talking about within the film.
Yes.
And so now I see something like this, and it just feels like another piece of, like, British, you know, stale pudding.
And because of timing, it will steal the thunder of that earlier film.
Well, yeah, because no one...
We didn't get sent an Academy consideration screener for Their Finest.
I know, and I've been bugging the distributor about that, because even just among LA Film Critics members, I've been talking this movie up, and people are like, oh, what, that? I didn't like the trailer. I didn't see that.
I didn't see it, really?
Yeah.
I mean, I do that all the time, but...
No,
but I do it for movies like The Star.
Right, well, yeah. In which case you would have been right.
That is correct.
Yeah, so even if I hadn't seen Their Finest and loved Their Finest, this movie, it is so that King's Speech.
Which, you know, I was into. I'm into the big, watchable, obvious, ham-fisted British period film. I am.
I'm sick of them.
I'm into it.
And there are a lot of cool movies coming out of Britain.
We got that Victoria and Abdul screener and...
You're going to watch it.
That mango is off.
and look, you should watch it for Judi Dench's performance.
That's right.
And I guess if you really want to see Gary Oldman's performance, that's the thing to get you through this. But even that, to me, felt kind of gimmicky.
I was entertained. It is gimmicky. It's a naked grab toward anything it can get.
It's the kind of thing so that in future... Life Achievement Award ceremonies, they can say, he played everyone from Sid Vicious to Winston Churchill.
Correct.
Hooray. Which is not nearly as good as the line in Martin Amis's novel Money, which is sort of a loose Romanoclay about his experience writing Saturn III.
Right.
The character in the novel, who's clearly intended to be Kirk Douglas, he says, over the course of his storied career, he'd played everyone from Picasso to Spider-Man.
I didn't hate this. It's not good.
Right.
But I enjoyed my time.
The tweeds and the lamps, with I'm the, sure, took you a long
Prime
way.
Minister. Yeah, always.
Yes. Okay.
Just always. So we're clear. Always. A couple of PG tips. I'm set with that kind of movie.
You're so mumsy.
I am. Who cares? I enjoy my life. As is.
Violet crumble and some tawny orange.
I don't like the violet crumble.
Really?
No.
Okay.
No.
Me neither.
The occasionally the taste of lavender in something is okay.
Uh-huh.
But I never took to that violet crumble.
Me neither.
Don't like it.
I'm with you.
Call me by your name.
Maybe.
No, you do it.
Call me maybe by your name.
Well, that would be cool.
But instead of Carly Rae Jepsen, we got Soup John Stevens, and that's fine.
It is fine.
I like the songs that he wrote for this.
He has that whispery kind of...
He does.
Baby iron and wine kind of voice. You know.
My favorite...
I say baby iron wine. I have no idea how old Sufjan Stephen is.
No,
is it Sufjan or Sufjan?
Sufjan, I think.
Sufjan?
Yeah.
I. You know what? It's funny because I don't talk about him very much. I never talk about him. And so... his name, I've always just read it and thought, well, someday I'm going to hear someone say his name.
A woman who is a friend of ours, I went to her apartment one time, and she and her then boyfriend, like all they played while I was there was Sufjan Stevens.
Uh-huh.
And I could never remember her boyfriend's name, so I would just call him Sufjan. Hey, how's Sufjan doing?
Talk about this movie.
Okay, so this is the latest from Luca Guadagnino, who is an Italian director that we both like a lot. Do you know that he had a feature before I Am Love? I just found this out on IMDb.
What was it called?
I forget, but he has one.
I'm going to look that
and
up.
I don't know that it ever got any play in the U.S. I'm kind of curious about it now. But this is his third big U.S. release,
yes,
following I Am Love and A Bigger Splash. And it is based on a novel adapted by the great James Ivory. And it is set in 1983, and it's an Italian summer, and there is Elio, played by Timothée Chalamet, who was in Lady Bird right now, and he was in a film last year that I really love called Miss Stevens.
Right.
And he is a musical prodigy, and he's spending the summer with his father, who's an academic. And every summer, the father has like a grad student intern who comes and stays with them. And this year, it is Oliver, played by Armie Hammer. Elio doesn't quite know what to make about his feelings about Oliver, because Oliver
We know right away what his feelings are, because the very first close-up of Armie Hammer is of his chest. The camera is seeing what Timothée Chalamet is seeing.
Right.
And what that young man is seeing is Armie Hammer's chest. And that's kind of all you need to know about what he thinks about Mr. Hammer.
So over the course of the summer, like the two of them sort of sussy.
Six weeks.
Is it 6 weeks?
6 weeks.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. It's a very short period of time.
Okay. Well, the movie drags it out. Yeah, I mean, it sure does. Not in a bad way, but it definitely
you get a sense of the languid.
Yes.
And yeah.
The passage of time or not over the course of long summer days. They suss each other out, and are they into each other? Are they not into each other? And eventually they're into each other, and it becomes very passionate. And then Oliver has to go home, and then their lives continue. It is one of the greatest love stories I've ever seen in a movie, in terms of describing how love unfolds, especially when it's the first time and when you're young and relatively inexperienced.
Right.
There's that feeling of there's so much of Elio's reticence and hesitance that stems from his own sort of discomfort in his own body lack of a kind of brash confidence.
Yeah.
And so the movie is a little over 2 hours long, and scenes will play out really long, takes will run really long.
Yes.
And it gives you that feeling of what, like, just those sort of long summer days that just feel like they're never going to end, and what it's like to be sort of eaten up with this desire that you don't know if you can act on or not. And movies are so usually about like the high points and the hot and heavy and the flaming passion of like love or hatred or whatever. And this is about the like, oh God, he's right there and I'm looking at him and I can't look at him and I want to touch him, but I can't touch him. And what does he think of me? Does he think of me?
Right.
I've seen this twice. I'm going to see it several more times. It's an amazing movie.
I do love that aspect of the film. That's not even a qualifying statement. Mm-hmm. I think this is a wonderful, beautiful movie. I agree with you that it's a great romance story. It's a beautiful love story. If we're gonna hold it up to the harsh light of reality, it is a fling. But flings are sometimes your first love.
Yeah,
and they don't last very long. They're gone after 6 weeks, maybe.
Yeah, but they color the rest of your life.
But they make such an impact on you that they listen. I dated guys before you. I dated guys for as little as 2 to 3 months, and those months left a mark on me. What I do love about this film is that sense of friction and tension and how do I make this work? And it's two people who both are trying to figure out how to express themselves. Mm-hmm. And one of them is a little bit older, but he is still in his mind and body still quite young and not experienced really much at all.
He is maybe post-adolescence.
Yeah. But the physicality of it, the atmosphere around the bodies, how bodies express frustration and how they express desire with all kinds of gestures. And you're right. If this were a mainstream American romantic drama or romantic comedy, we would go through, you know, a series of direct actions that each character takes to get to the place of love. And the love would be the climax. It wouldn't be the understood situation at the beginning. And so this moves, you know, differently in that way as well. Also, I loved that it took place in 1983, where the world of being gay, whether you were in the United States or Europe, was fairly the same, you know. You were, unless you were in one of the big cities and already moving with a crowd of openly gay people, AIDS probably had not come to your world yet. And, but the closet had. And the closet really colors the actions of these two young men in this film. It isn't necessarily a problem with Elio's family, who they know what's going on, and they want his life to be easier than it might be for someone else. So they're quite supportive. But there are so many moments in the film where, do we touch? Is it okay to touch? Can I speak to you here? Can we talk about these things here? There are things I need to say to you, but I can't say them to you. Can I hold your hand here? Can I kiss you here? What are our futures going to be like? Do we still need to make a show of
heterosexuality?
Do we, in fact, maybe want to incorporate opposite sex relationships into our lives? Are we gay? Are we bisexual? Are we something in between? There are all of these questions, and they're all expressed in minor moments.
Yeah, glances and yes, half lines of dialogue.
And so I really like that this moment in time is explored. I know, based on just checking it up on IMDb, that Luca Guadagnino has a sequel in mind.
Yes, which I don't know. I think it's this is such a perfect little thing. I don't know that I want another one, you know?
Right.
But what's interesting also is you mentioned the closet, and I think, yes, but at the same time, it's not, I don't think either character has a problem with the idea of being gay or being perceived as gay as much as they have no roadmap as to how that works or what it looks like.
But they do know that the world around them has to be navigated.
Sure. No, I mean, they know about discretion for sure.
You have to pay attention to the world around you.
Of course.
Or you could be in danger.
Absolutely.
Yes.
But there isn't like, it's not like Brokeback Mountain.
No.
Where there's this active sense of like, oh, can't be that.
The crushing straitjacket of heterosexuality. Yeah.
The other thing about Guadagnino that I love, and when we've reviewed his films in the past, I've mentioned this. I think that he's one of the very few filmmakers who expresses the other three senses through his work. You know, you taste his movies, you smell his movies, you touch his movies.
Right.
And he explores and portrays so much of that here. You know, the fruits of the vineyard and the grass under bare feet. You know, you really occupy this space in his films that I think is really overwhelming, that you don't get from so many other filmmakers.
Yeah. And you know, he's a queer filmmaker, so he understands this material intimately.
Yeah. And as is James Ivory. So
yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I heard, you know, this premiered at Sundance. This movie's been bouncing around for a while.
Right.
And I had heard some gays be all like, there's not enough nudity. There's not enough sex. And it's like,
well, that's what Pornhub is for.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, I don't think it's that thing where you know, we don't have gay indies that give you that, and we don't have other gay films that will give you that stuff. But at the same time, I also don't feel like that this movie is in any way hedging its bets. I mean, yes, even if both the actors said, you know, I'll do this but not that, the movie itself, I don't feel lacks for any of that stuff, because again, that sensuality is so strong. I mean, just the notion of, like, these guys share a bathroom, and Oliver leaves his swim trunk sort of splayed out over all the, like, faucets and stuff in the movie.
Don't give that away.
Well, I was just like, there's a...
Because there's a thing that happens.
Absolutely. But yeah. just even that suggests this sense of intimacy that I'd never seen in a movie before.
Right.
That I was kind of like, oh yeah, that's a thing that would... And the other person would notice that thing, and okay, you know.
Yes.
You know, so I feel like in a lot of ways it is very true to this kind of queer passion without giving you, like, the humpty hump you might be expecting.
I you know, obviously joking about Pornhub, but I don't think that that we are lacking for good gay male themed films that have explicit sexual content.
Yeah.
You might not have seen them or knew they existed, but they are out there.
I mean, if you watched American Gods...
I'm not even talking about television. I'm talking about theatrically released films. I'm talking about Teo and Hugo from last year, which had actors who had real sex on camera.
Yeah.
And as explicit as any... thing that you would see on Pornhub, but done in a way that was relevant to the
story and the
story of the characters.
BPM, same thing.
BPM has
not the same level of explicitness, but nonetheless,
BPM has sexually explicit material in it.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is, I don't think it's necessary for us to pin all of our
gay movie hopes
on one.
Yeah,
it just happens to be the best one to come along in a while.
Yeah, and it's the one that more people are going to see.
And it doesn't necessarily need Armie Hammer's actual boner to make it better.
Yeah. So go see it. It's in New York and L.A.
Armie Hammer can keep his actual boner to himself if he wants.
That's fine. But Timothée Chalamet, you know, for all the attention that Gary Oldman is going to get for...
that young man.
He is so... great in this, and navigate so many, like, subtle moments where all these things are flashing across his face, and for his big bravura moment, you sit through the closing credits of this movie.
Yeah,
I'll leave it at that. But he's extraordinary, and that is the best male lead performance of this year.
He ends it in the same Guadagnino ends it in the same way that he ended I Am Love.
Correct.
Yeah. So. Action taking place over those credits.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I saw something you did not see.
I did not.
I saw the new Hong Sang-soo film. It's called On the Beach at Night Alone.
Why don't you explain to people who Hong Sang-soo is?
He is a Korean filmmaker, and he has made a lot of... what's the right word? Everyday realism.
Okay.
Sort of dramas.
Kitchen sink naturalism?
Well, I'm not going to go. I wouldn't use the kitchen sink word.
Okay.
But
I didn't mean it to be disparaging.
No, it's not disparaging, but it evokes poverty and England, and that's not what we're talking about,
okay,
really.
Fine.
What
are some of his other films?
Well, his career began in the 90s with The Day a Pig Fell into the Well.
That's a naturalist title.
Not about a pig falling into a well.
Oh, then it's not.
Woman is the Future of Man. What else came along after that? I was scrolling here. Related to this film particularly is a film from 2015 called Right Now, Wrong Then, which was acclaimed at the time. And so, On the Beach at Night Alone stars the woman who was in Right Now, Wrong Then.
Okay.
Kim Min-hee. Now, Kim Min-hee was best known by American audiences as star of The Handmaiden from last year, year before.
Yeah. One of those.
Anyway, in The Handmaiden, she was Lady Hideko.
Ah.
So I guess she was the heiress.
Right.
The, yeah. Okay. Anyway, on the set of Right Now, Wrong Then, Hong Sang-soo, a married man, had an affair with Kim Min-hee. And it became a big scandal in South Korea.
Hmm.
And so then, Hong Sang-soo, who did not divorce his wife, and who ended the affair with Kim Min-hee, made this film with Kim Min-hee called On the Beach at Night Alone. It is the story of a woman who has an affair with her director, and he kind of takes off, and she takes off too, and they don't stay together, but she has to deal with the aftermath of that.
Like the public aftermath, the wife's aftermath?
The private aftermath.
I see.
So the film opens and she's in Germany visiting an old friend. And that's the first half of the film. And the second half is she returns to South Korea and is hanging out with other friends and then eventually re-encounters the director.
Hmm.
Now, along the way, you could look at this movie and say not much happens. Now, this is not the kind of durational cinema that people are who listen to this show are used to me talking about and praising. These are not, you know, 15-minute takes where
people watch dogs.
Where, you know, cows walk around a muddy field. It's not, that's not what this is. These are a series of scenes where people are interacting with each other and having seemingly slight and inconsequential conversations, but that's not what's going on at all. This woman is sorting out her damaged self from this, you know, scandal that has taken place. And she unleashes her fury at strange times, and she expresses emotions at strange times. And it leads up to a confrontation that she has with the director that is squirmingly uncomfortable to watch.
And there's an actor playing the director.
There's an actor playing the director. Hong Sang-soo does not play himself, no. But this is one of my favorite female lead performances that I've seen all year. It is as precise and controlled a portrait of like rage and depression and the bouncing back from that sort of thing, which is always sort of slow and halting. And she's phenomenal in this film. It's a really great movie. It takes a while, I think, for people unaccustomed to Hong Sang-soo to get used to his way of characters expressing themselves. Because they can sit there for 5 minutes talking about the soup they're eating. And they're not exactly talking about the soup they're eating. Someone will start arguing with somebody else about something completely unrelated to the soup. And then your attention is redirected to those other people, and you're thinking, what's going on now? Why are they yelling at each other? Like, here's the weirdest part. Kim Min-hee not only made On the Beach at Night Alone with Hong Sang-soo, but the other two films that Hong Sang-soo has directed in 2017... Claire's Camera and The Day After, both of which screened recently here at a film festival.
Mm-hmm.
They star Kim Min-hee.
So Mrs. Hong Sang-soo is cool with all this, apparently.
I don't know if she's cool with it, but she's not budging.
I see.
And they continue to work with each other.
Hmm.
I can't wait to see Claire's Camera and The Day After because I want to know if this is going to work itself out like a John Doe and Exene situation. In public, where their relationship is always the subtext of what's going on
right.
in the art.
How many nights did this play in Los Angeles?
A couple, Downtown Independent. And, but Cinema Guild, indie distribution company, Cinema Guild has it.
Okay.
So if you go look up this movie, On the Beach at Night Alone, it's playing in a variety of American cities, sometimes a couple nights, sometimes one off at a museum some night. I went and looked it up. So if you're interested in this, go look it up, because it might actually be coming to you.
Yeah.
You might have to...
Especially if you live in a college town.
Rearrange your schedule to get to the one screening or whatever, but... this is definitely one of my favorite movies that I've seen this year.
Hmm.
Okay. It's really something. And, again, there's performance by Kim Min Hee. I mean, if you liked her in The Handmaiden, and... come on.
Who didn't?
Who didn't? That you... She's really talented and cool.
Cool.
Yeah.
So instead of DVDs this week...
And then we watched Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And I don't like you anymore. You did this to me.
You said you wanted to watch it with me. I would have happily looked at it alone, away from your eyeballs, you were like, oh no.
It was late. I was lazy. I was on the couch. You said, you came out of the, you went to Mount Unwatched, and you brought back two Blu-rays. One was Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. The other was Wonton Tom, the Dog Who Saved Hollywood.
Yes.
And I said, sure, fine, whatever.
But some time ago, I was going to watch Sgt. Pepper, and you said, no, 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 save that so we can both watch it. So you
why you got to put me on blast?
Because you put me on blast first.
All right, so here's the thing. We do not have DVDs to recommend this week.
These are more of a warning.
We watched two DVDs this week. And I was, admittedly... truthfully, curious about both of them.
Mm-hmm.
Having already seen both of them as a kid.
In their original theatrical run.
In their original theatrical run.
Which now, I did see Sgt. Pepper, but did not see Wonton Tom.
Sgt. Pepper was from 1979.
Nine or eight?
78, 79? I 78. Can't remember. 78, 79, whatever. The cocaine 1970s.
Somebody commented, sure, we did a lot of cocaine, but it's all there on the screen.
Yes. it is a wall-to-wall musical.
Jukebox musical.
Yes. The entire album of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Except for two songs, I think.
Sure.
Lovely Rita and something else.
Yeah.
And then a bunch of Abbey Road.
Performed by... the Bee Gees, Peter Frampton, a woman named Sandy Farina, who never was in another movie again, to my knowledge, although she became a...
Songwriter and commercial vocalist.
There is Earth, Wind & Fire. There is a late 70s R&B girl group called Starguard. If you are old enough, you perhaps remember their one big hit called Which Way Is Up, which was the theme to a film of the same name.
Which was directed by Michael Schultz, who also directed Sgt. Yes. Pepper.
This film also has Aerosmith, Alice Cooper,
George Burns, Steve Martin,
Donald Pleasance. And it is a disaster of crazy
mammoth
making.
Proportions.
Yeah. I remember as a kid seeing it in its theatrical run and thinking, there's something wrong here, because I had seen Tommy again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
And really, when I saw the trailer for Sgt. Pepper, I thought, oh, they're doing this like Tommy. And so that sparked my interest, though I didn't really have any interest in the Beatles at all.
The difference is that Tommy was an album that came with a story already attached to it.
Yes.
And this was trying to jerry-rig a story out of a handful of songs that were disconnected.
Guess what? you don't want to try to do that to this album, because what you end up with is a far less giddy and exciting version of The Apple.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which came 2 years later, and I'm thinking they must have been taking notes.
The Apple is so bonkers and so... gobsmacking, you know, in its strange, you know, mysterious audacity, that I can't watch The Apple enough times. I want to watch The Apple again and again and again.
Yeah, you always see new things.
I never want to see Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band again.
I think I'm good.
My adult curiosity is sated. And yet, if you find yourself curious about it, I half recommend that you do sit down and watch it, because it's a time capsule.
Yes.
For its moment. And kind of valuable in that regard.
To quote, I forget what critic once used this line, but has to be seen not to be believed.
Yeah.
Because it seems like such a terrible idea on so many fronts, and such an excuse for a soundtrack, which is the one thing they got out of it that was successful.
Yeah.
The album was huge.
Yeah.
But... yeah, the Beatles had not been broken up for a decade.
Not yet.
You know, and here they are, like, making this grotesque, elephantine musical.
Yep.
With a mixture of, like, pop stars of the day and people who had no business singing anything in a movie. And it's weird. Like, I always point to, you know, you can never... like outright say that a certain genre or a certain type of filmmaking is going to be a bad idea, because you could argue that Singin' in the Rain and Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band both have a similar genesis.
Yeah.
It's like, we're going to take a songbook from this set of songwriters and we're going to somehow build a musical out of them. And if you don't have Comden and Green, like, firing on all cylinders and coming up with this amazing sort of spoof of old Hollywood, you wind up with this cokey, bloated, ridiculous thing.
Yeah.
But, I never need to see it again, but I'm glad I've seen it just to be able to be like, yeah, that's a thing that exists.
When they sing A Day in the Life and the lyrics go, I woke up, I got out of bed, I dragged a comb across my head, Barry Gibb.
Does those things.
Combs his hair, yeah. when they sing Golden Slumbers and they say...
you got to carry that
weight. Boy, you're going to carry that weight. They're
pallbearing.
They're pallbearing Strawberry Fields, played by Sandy Farina.
Yes.
And
that's the character name.
When everyone has to get magically righted into their original states of innocence, or bad characters have to be righted into states of goodness... Billy Preston plays a weather vane that jumps off a roof and magically electrocutes people back into those situations by singing, Get Back to Where You Once Belonged.
Yeah, it's like...
This is that movie.
There's literal Deus Ex Machina going on
here. There is no lyric that is not displayed and acted in a literal way.
Yeah, it's like a panto or
it's
something.
It's the stupidest thing.
You have characters named Strawberry Fields and Lucy and Mr. Mustard and Dr. Maxwell just to fit. It's just terrible. Then there's Wanton Tom, the dog who saved Hollywood, which I had never seen. Explain.
All right. So in the 70s... there was a fascination with the 20s and 30s.
Yes.
Every era has nostalgia that is sort of a resurrection of an earlier era.
Yeah,
and it's a trending thing.
Usually
it's
for the period that young adults just missed the first time.
So right now, you know, all the millennials are hardcore into the 90s.
Right.
And before them, the Gen Yers were all about the 80s.
Yeah.
And before them, we were all about resurrecting the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And the baby boomers were really into, for some reason, they were really into the 20s and 30s.
Well, you had Bonnie and Clyde that made the 20s
Bonnie
chic.
And Clyde, and then the Casablanca revival.
And the Marx Brothers.
The Marx Brothers, the W.C. Fields sort of revival that happened. And so...
I think also, real quick, I just want to throw in, I think that for 1970s movies, there was the appeal of telling stories of the 30s and 40s after the production code was over, so you could sort of go back and be like naughty and sweary and stuff. Like Chinatown is the sort of the perfect example of like, here's an old school noir film, but made with an R rating, so we can be honest about like sex and drugs and
human depravity.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so someone had the big idea to satirize the life of a famous dog actor, Rin Tin Tin.
Yes.
So this movie, Juan Tan Tan, about a German shepherd, Rin Tin Tin was a German shepherd. So
right.
We've got Juan Tan Tan, who's a German shepherd, and it's about his rise to stardom, and his actress keeper, played by Madeline Kahn, whose own career sort of parallels, you know, crisscrosses. One of them is famous when one of them isn't. One of them is the other one becomes famous while the other one hits the skids, you know. And it stars Madeline Kahn, Terry Garr,
Bruce Dern,
Art Carney. Those are the four main characters. But it also stars as many living people from the silent era and the
early talkies
as they can get on camera. And so you have, I mean, the credit screens at the credit sequence at the beginning is, it goes on forever. Because there's about 30 people who come in and come out and have a line or two. It's all cameos. But here's what's wrong. It's a film that's aimed at kids. It's a dog movie aimed at kids. And I saw this dog movie aimed at kids when I was 11.
Yeah, then the humor is not sophisticated or clever at all. So it's totally this kid movie that's also built on nostalgia that only old people would have.
Correct. So I remember seeing this movie as an 11-year-old.
And you weren't thrilled at the Rhonda Fleming cameo?
I knew Madeline Kahn from What's Up, Doc? And Young Frankenstein, and I was very happy because I thought she was cool. She is, always was, and Terry Garr from Young Frankenstein as well. But I didn't recognize or care about any of these cameos from any of these old-timey people because I was a kid and didn't know who they were. I guess the fact that this film holds the distinction of being the first movie I ever saw in an otherwise empty movie theater should have told me maybe something at the time, like, oh, I'm alone here. My memory played tricks on me because I thought that Listomania was the first one that I saw in an empty theater, but I was alone in there, but I had snuck into it when I was supposed to be at the kid that day because it was rated R and it was real dirty.
Right.
But no one saw me pop into that house. I just was like, I'm theater hopping. Goodbye. Here I come, Listomania. But Juan Tan Tan was at that same theater, not at the same time, obviously, because they were released in different times. But no one else I knew at school saw that movie. And for a while, it took on the quality of, was that a real movie?
Did I dream this?
Did I have a dream that I saw that movie? Because it was as though it disappeared. It was a huge flop.
Yeah.
The only thing that kept me from thinking that it wasn't a dream was that before it was released, the premiere of the movie took up an entire episode of the Merv Griffin Show.
Of course it did.
And I remember that. And Merv Griffin just cooing over all these old-timey...
Ooh, Sid Charisse.
All these old-timey Hollywood people that, again, at age 11, could not have cared less about or known anything about.
Yeah, like Stepan Fetchit is in this movie.
Yeah, you would have... Only if the film had come with subtitles that said, this is Stepan Fetchit, and here's why he's significant in film history. Yeah,
there should be a pop-up video version of this movie.
Yeah.
Because that's all that it has to offer is this parade because of
it literally is a movie for kids with some adult stuff in it that kids should not be exposed to.
But... Right. Yeah, there's a scene where like they become prostitutes. It's hilarious.
Right. You know? And there's a whole lot of...
Homophobia.
Homophobia and casting couch stuff And as you know, as you're watching it when you're 11, you're thinking, I don't know what any of this means. He's chasing that lady around the room. I don't get it. You know, so I was not a sophisticated 11-year-old.
This was a movie. I mean, as a kid, I remember like the ads for it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I remember it going away. And then years later, it pops up in one of the MedVed books.
Yeah.
You know, of like all time disasters or whatever. But
it's tedious.
Yeah, it's not fun.
And the only thing that gets you through it is Madeline Kahn.
Yes, who is always in a universe of her own.
Right, and she. She takes material that is beneath her and treats it like she deserves to be there and it deserves her.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a curiosity. If you have that curiosity, you could watch it.
You know, have IMDb open because it lists out all the people who are in it in order of their appearance.
Yeah,
so you can sort of keep up.
And you can keep up.
Because, like, there might be some scene where there's, like, three, you know, baggage porters or something, and they're all played by, you know, like the Ritz brothers or whatever.
Got some letters.
Yep.
Hello, Alonzo. Hello, Dave. Greetings from Russia.
Oh.
Have we ever heard from anyone in Russia before?
This might be our first.
I want to say that we have.
Okay.
I have this memory of someone in Russia already talking to us once, and now I can't remember.
Well, das vidanya.
My name is Victoria. And I've been listening to your wonderful podcast for the last 2 years. Earlier this year, I even listened to all of the episodes since 2010.
Ooh.
Oh, man.
There's some doozies in there.
Because I had broken my arm and had plenty of time on my, well, hand. And let me tell you, it was time well spent. Well,
aww.
Thank you. I find your reviews interesting, your banter delightful, and your enthusiastic roast of terrible movies endlessly entertaining. Every Monday morning, I wake up thinking about your podcast, and it always makes me a bit happier. Basically, I'm in love with you. Parenthetically, she adds, slightly more with Dave. Sorry, Alonzo.
Oh, fine. It's my lot in life.
Everybody likes Dave. What is especially valuable for me is your reviews of LGBTQ-themed movies. Having known about my own bisexuality for years, I've done lots of research and seen plenty of movies, but it's always nice to hear someone else speaking about it. I want to share a little miracle that happened in my smallish hometown last week. I'm painfully aware that living in a Russian provincial town of what living in a Russian provincial town means. People here are not the most open-minded in the world, and most of them don't really understand why sexism and homophobia are bad. However, last week, one of our largest cinemas participated in an American cinema festival, and I cannot express my absolute ecstasy and incredulity when I saw Call Me By Your Name in the program. It is an explicit gay drama on a big screen in a small Russian town. I could not believe my eyes, and I immediately bought two tickets for myself and any of my friends that were willing to go. I was really nervous from excitement and also from the fear that the showing would be somehow interrupted or canceled altogether. In the last few years, the religious and traditionalist views have become much more prominent in Russia, so now I'm a bit paranoid and scared most of the time. Well, that makes me feel bad. But that time, it was a truly miraculous event. Not only was there no hindrance in the showing itself, but the cinema added a second viewing of that movie because the first one sold out.
Well, there
in
you
go. A couple of days. And I loved Call Me By Your Name so, so much. It felt natural and raw. It was tender and sexy and absolutely, absolutely heartbreaking. That is a
yes.
fact. Everything was right, but I didn't make the ending, but it didn't make the ending any less sad. The mutual desire and longing of the main characters were simply contagious. It's been 5 days, and I still can't stop thinking about them and about my own desperate need to live life to its fullest. I feel like after seeing it, everyone went home feeling a little braver, a little more willing to experience life with all of its pain and happiness. I'm sorry for this long email and for major rambling. I really wanted to share this happy moment with you. I look forward to your review of Call Me By Your Name. I'm sure you'll have plenty to say about it. Hope you have the nicest weekend. Love, Victoria. Thank you.
Thank you, Victoria.
Victoria, that's the sweetest letter
that
we've received in a while. And, you know...
things are sucky for the gay right now in Russia, I know, but, you know, stay strong.
Stay strong and stay safe, please.
Yes.
So, yeah. Thank you again. This next one is from Kent.
Kent.
Kent. I've recently become an avid listener of Linoleum Knife and have very much enjoyed consuming your menu of delicious, delicious content. If reading on air, feel free to insert a Linoleum Knife and Fork plug here. Why not?
Sure.
I will do that right now. If you go to patreon.com/linoleumknife, you will see the many options you have to subscribe to extra content from us. There is a TV podcast called LKTV. There is a food podcast called Linoleum Knife and Fork, which we always describe as a food podcast hosted by two film critics. And we are as qualified to discuss that topic as any other film critic. There is also Linoleum Nights. There is merchandise. There is club stuff that you can do with us, watching movies with us, talking about the movie at the same time we watch it. Many things. Go there. Look it up. Just don't join at the $20 a month level.
Stop.
I love all of you who have joined at the $20 a month level, and I don't want you to think that I don't appreciate you, but there are now a lot of you, and keeping up with all of you is it's a lot of work, and I fail at it so often, and I'm constantly running behind, and so, you know, anything less than the $16, anything less than the $20 a month level is great. And I saw the person who upgraded to $20 this week, and I'm watching you.
See, people are thinking that you're like trying to reverse psychology by begging them not to join the 20 level.
Reverse psychology. Don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I got my eyes on you, guy who upgraded. Anyway.
Continue with Kent's letter, please.
I'm actually a newcomer to the world of cinema. Aside from the usual big-name blockbuster titles, I finally begun to delve deeper into the more obscure areas of the film landscape. I came across many absolute gems and was not only delighted to have found them, but also shocked that nobody had ever told me about these movies before. I'm sure that you struggle regularly with the problem as cinema lovers who work so hard to promote quality films, many of which never get the publicity or viewership they deserve. But more to the point, my question for you is there a movie that you saw and immediately thought, why the F didn't anyone tell me about this movie before?
Well, weirdly, The Apple, actually,
well,
I remember.
Yeah.
In writing the Christmas movie book, there were definitely a lot of films that I was amazed that they had just sort of traveled under my radar, like that I had never seen The Silent Partner before,
mm-hmm.
or I had never seen Remember the Night, or I'll Be Seeing You, you know, like just films that I'd never heard of or vaguely knew existed, but just never seen it. Like, then they were amazing. They blew me away. So, yeah, I mean, I've even heard Bibbs say when he thinks about like movies that he knows he needs to see, that he likes the fact that there's always something for him to look forward to.
Yeah.
And he doesn't ever feel like, oh, well, seen them all.
I'm
covered.
Right.
You know, so rather than think about movies you haven't seen yet as like, oh, how did I miss this? You know that there is such a wide landscape out there of movies. There's always some cool area to discover.
For me, as a kid who was movie obsessed and whose father subscribed to the Boston Herald, because we lived in a small town in New Hampshire, I would look at the Boston newspaper on Sunday,
mm-hmm.
and see all the films that were never coming to our town.
I did that with the Sunday New York Times as a kid.
And so many of them were from other countries.
Yeah. Satyricon.
And I would think to myself, when I'm grown up and I go live in a big city, I'm going to get to see these movies. And so I think there was always the understanding on my part that no one was helping me find these things. I was on my own to go find these things. And I had a hunger to find these things. And so I remember the very first subtitled film I saw. It was on HBO, and I was so excited. HBO was going to show a French movie. This was 1979, 80. Like, we were early getters of HBO.
Mm-hmm.
And
was it Get Out Your Handkerchiefs?
It was Get Out Your Handkerchiefs. And I just remember thinking, oh man, I'm reading a movie. And and so along, you know, the years go on, and I discover more and more things. And I guess the most, even though I know that I'm on my own to find this stuff, the world has caught up a bit to that and helps you quite often. But I'm always a bit surprised when I do stumble across something that, like the films of a filmmaker that had never crossed my path before, and that very few people that I knew were talking about. But that maybe I knew vaguely that they existed, but no one in my world was saying, oh, you really need to see all of the films of Strobe Huillier.
Or Ida Lupino,
yeah. And so, or Shirley Clarke, you know, like I'm, when I get to that spot, that's when I think, okay, so sure, nobody around told me this, or if they did mention it in passing, maybe I wasn't paying attention, or the names flew past me, or whatever. But now I'm ready. And now I'm going to go dig into the films of this filmmaker. So that's how it is with me. Here we go. He continues. My example is A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, which was one of the most beautiful movie viewing experiences I've ever had, and yet there are surprisingly few reviews or online discussions about it out there. I actually had a moment during the middle of the film where I had to stop the movie and rewatch a scene multiple times because I was so moved. So there. With love from your fan in Canada, Kent.
Thank you, Kent. I need to see that one.
We're getting all the different countries
today. I saw her follow-up movie this past year and did not care for it.
Phil says, I've heard every word you two have uttered on your own podcasts, and I can say that Alonzo has never uttered the parody title, Smila Smelt of Smelts. LOL, I would have remembered it.
So there, Dave White. Get off my back.
That's the end. We're done.
Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. We always appreciate it. And you can check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Check out Bibbs and Whitney on Cancel Too Soon and on their new show, Critically Acclaimed, that's on the Schmoes Know Network.
Yep.
Of course, also go check out the Schmoes Know. Yep. Dennis Henwin with Dennis Hensley, All Things Cozy, the Comics Canon, Fat Guys of the Movies, the Criterion Cast, the Sewers of Paris, Film Spotting SVU, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to the show for free on iTunes and kindly leave us a 5-star review while you're there. It does help people find the show.
This is like Uber and Lyft. I don't need no 4 stars from you. If you got 4 stars in your mind, keep it to yourself. 5.
Put it in your pocket.
Yeah.
You can also leave us positive feedback at all the places where we stream, like Stitcher Radio and Google Play and TheLounge.com and CastBox and Podbean and iVooks. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at LinoleumCast. You can drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com. And hey, join our club at Patreon.com/LinoleumKnife. Quick thing about your Christmas shopping habits, since it is that time of year.
Oh, yeah.
If you go to the show notes or if you look on our Facebook page, every week when we do our DVD picks, or this week when we talk about the crazy, you know, Sergeant Pepper's and Wonton Ton, we post Amazon links and they have a code where we get a kickback from them. Yeah. Even if you aren't going to buy a copy of Wonton Ton, The Dog Who Saved Hollywood, if you click on
that link, you probably shouldn't.
If you click on any of our Amazon links when you go shopping on Amazon, you don't have to buy the thing that we are linking to, but if that's how you got into the site and then you just go on and shop for your own stuff,
We get a little money.
Yeah, so that's cool. Another way to support the show. Even if you can't Patreon us or whatever, or get a t-shirt, you can always give us a little Amazon kickback.
I had somebody think, because we always joke about how that's the Metamucil money.
Yes.
I had somebody recently say, so all of your Patreon money goes to Metamucil? No.
Just quite a bit of it.
We would be living in a Metamucil warehouse.
We don't make that much off of Amazon, but nonetheless, we appreciate what we do, and everybody
it's
who
literal pennies.
Everybody who clicks on that, it does help. We appreciate it. It's a way to support the program. So anyway, y'all are great. Thanks. We will be back next week with more movies, and depending on when we tape it, I'll even give you the scoop about how the LA Film Critics voting goes down, because that's going to be next Sunday, December 3rd. So until then.
Goodbye.